be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by and hear the bands. They haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come home.
And that's it for this week's episode. And don't forget to share your thoughts and comments with us. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Britain's oil and gas companies have reported bumper profits as the gas crisis raises the price at which they can sell their fossil fuels without raising the cost of their extraction. While they're being showered with cash, households in the United Kingdom are suffering the biggest fall in income in 3 decades. With 1 in 10 households not having enough money for food and food bank use soaring. We'll prepare for you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled Facts Give Lie to Claim Record Oil Money is Being Poured into Green Projects. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The Chief Financial Officer of Britain's oil and gas company, BP, Murray Auchincloss, told investors recently, "It's possible that we're getting more cash than we know what to do with." Oil and gas companies have reported bumper profits as the gas crisis raises the price at which they can sell their fossil fuels without raising the cost of their extraction. While they're being showered with cash, households in Britain are suffering the biggest fall in income in 3 decades. With 1 in 10 households not having enough money for food and food bank use soaring. Recently, BP reported a profit of £9.4 billion for last year, following Shell's recent announcement of $19.3 billion in profits. Little of the money is going to taxpayers. Channel 4 revealed that BP has paid no tax on its North Sea oil and gas for 5 years. Bernard Looney, the chief executive of BP, told analysts he was not seeing increased pressure for the company to pay more tax, despite calls in Britain for a windfall tax on fossil fuel profits to ease the burden of energy bills under vulnerable. Instead, Bernard Looney and other senior managers in the fossil fuel industry have sought to justify their bonanza on the grounds that the billions of extra cash is needed to pour into their transition to low-carbon companies. The facts of oil and gas company investment do not bear out the claim that the massive returns are being poured into green projects and the race to net zero greenhouse gas emissions. Chris Venables of the Green Alliance think tank said, "The time for oil and gas companies to have invested in the clean energy transition was 2 decades ago, when they were peddling climate change denialism. If they were serious about renewable energy, they would be doing it right now, but instead their investments are largely going to new oil and gas, so this is a disingenuous argument." According to the International Energy Agency, IEA, investment in clean energy by oil and gas companies were about 1% of their capital expenditure in 2020, a proportion likely to have reached little more than 4% for the whole of last year. Meanwhile, the companies are continuing to invest vast sums in exploration and new fields, which the International Energy Agency, IEA, said last year could not be brought to fruition if the world was to limit global heating to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. BP plans to invest about £2 billion to £3 billion in renewable energy by 2025, but its overall capital investment will be £60 billion, most of which is likely to go into new production that will raise greenhouse gas emissions. The company is estimated to have spent about $3.2 billion on clean energy since 2016 and $84 billion on oil and gas exploration and development over the same 5-year period. Bernard Looney claimed the vast majority of investment in the United Kingdom would be in the energy transition, but then admitted that this amounted to 40% of its spending budget by 2025, rising to 50% of the budget by the end of the decade. The green spending is likely also to include projects such as blue hydrogen, derived from fossil fuels that critics say produces substantially higher carbon emissions than natural gas. Shell's plans involve an estimated near-term investment of about $2 to $3 billion in low-carbon activities, which is about 10% of its investments, while spending at least $8 billion on upstream fossil fuel production. Richard Black, a senior associate at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit think tank, says, "The key point about oil and gas majors arguing that higher profits are needed to invest in greening their operations is, prove it. If they argue that that is why high profits are justified, they should pledge publicly that a sizable proportion will be invested in proven technologies, like wind power, solar power and storage, rather than blue hydrogen or carbon capture and storage, which are either of unproven potential or several years off." Richard Black was skeptical of whether oil and gas companies would do so. He said, "Past experience suggests that the oil and gas industry is strong on rhetoric when it comes to cleaning up their act, but investment is still inadequate. If they were to make these commitments with a time frame for spending and set up an independent panel of arbiters to verify their commitments, then maybe it would have some credibility." The Labour Party has called for a windfall tax to ease pressure on energy bills, but oil and gas companies have claimed it would discourage them from investing in low-carbon technologies. Green campaigners doubted these claims. Charlie Cronick, a senior climate advisor at Greenpeace, said Shell certainly doesn't need the threat of a windfall tax to discourage them from properly investing in renewable energies. They're already failing to do so. Charlie Cronick said funding the transition is a convenient excuse to protect their bloated profits. There's no guarantee that any oil company will use the extra cash from this year's bumper profits for the green transition unless they're forced to do so. Yet the British government continues to talk up new production of oil and gas, which will only make the climate emergency worse. According to Connor Schwartz, the climate lead at Friends of the Earth, part of the problem was government failure to shift the balance of economic incentives away from fossil fuels. Connor Schwartz said, it's clear that oil and gas companies don't intend to divert their eye-watering excessive profits to fund the green transition that we need. They have no profit-based reason to do this, because drilling for oil and gas is more lucrative than investing in cheap green energy. Connor Schwartz added, this is partly due to government handouts in the form of subsidies and tax breaks, which reward huge multinationals for exacerbating climate breakdown instead of penalising them. He added, it's wrong that they're making billions while so many are struggling to eat and heat their homes. People know injustice when they see it. Any government that genuinely wants to help people out of a national crisis would introduce a windfall tax on these profiteering, damaging companies.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles, from very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities. Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Talks are resumed in Vienna to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of such talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. has so far failed to remove its maximum pressure sanctions, which it imposed on Iran after the former pulled out of the JCPOA, and give guarantees that a future administration will not ditch the deal again. Now Iran's top security chief said that there is no coherence coming from the U.S., on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Ali Shamkhani has stressed that the U.S. administration cannot impose the cost of its internal disputes on Iran.
And I think that now what we are witnessing is a division internally in the United States in the political establishment, both Democrats and Republicans, regarding a resolution to the ongoing situation with Iran regarding whether to go back to the table and to rejoin the JCPOA. We know that Biden has made overtures, and the State Department has said that they would grant some concessions in the forms of sanctions waivers. But like many Iranian commentators and politicians and diplomats have said, it doesn't go far enough.
Voices from the U.S. government show that there is no coherence in the country to make political decisions in the direction of advancements in the Vienna talks. The U.S. administration cannot pay for its internal disputes by violating Iran's legal rights. Envoys from Iran and the P4 plus one group of countries, Britain, France, Russia, and China plus Germany, have been holding negotiations in the Austrian capital for 10 months in a bid to resurrect the JCPOA.
And I think that there's not much appetite for a deal with Iran at this point. I think the Trump administration did tremendous damage to the JCPOA by removing itself from it.
The new round of talks comes amid rising hawkish voices in the U.S. A group of 33 U.S. Republican senators, led by Senator Ted Cruz, wrote a letter to President Biden warning him that any deal with Iran on restoring the JCPOA requires Senate approval. The senators warned Biden that they will do everything in their power to block a possible deal if he moves forward without them. They also said that the implementation of any agreement will be severely, if not terminally, hampered if the Biden administration does not fulfill a range of obligations in relation to congressional oversight over any agreements. The Republican senators said that if there is a deal that does not have Senate approval, it would be subject to being reversed as soon as there is a new president.
We see that the United States has been belligerent and has continued to put what it calls a maximum pressure campaign on the Iranian people, on the Iranian state, on the legal and legitimate Iranian government. And we see it as a web of coordinated activities By which we also know that Israel and the Zionist lobby are also pushing very heavily in the United States, in Washington.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. The pressure campaign was led by the Israeli and Arab lobby groups in the U.S. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it is willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage.
So I think that the internal divisions in the United States politically will continue to give free rein to the national security state in the United States to continue to put maximum pressure on Iran. But we know very well that Iran is a sovereign country and it will defend itself.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the onus falls on the U.S. to remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic in a verifiable manner and guarantee that a new U.S. administration would not breach the JCPOA again.
Neither East nor West, Islamic Republic. This famous slogan summarizes Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution and the people's fervent opposition to Cold War rivals, the United States and the Soviet Union, the two powers that then polarized the world sharply along the East-West divide. The slogan, which later became the Iranian foreign policy motto, was inspired by the ideas of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, who blamed the two powers for many problems faced by Iran and the Islamic world. He believed Muslims should reject the influence of both capitalism and communism. At the onset of the Islamic Revolution, many Iranians were tired of exploitation that culminated into Iran's losing big chunks of its territory to other countries. Therefore, the revolution kindled their hopes of independence and liberty. Iran's occupation by British and Russian empires in two world wars and the country's economic exploitation, directly or indirectly, were still fresh in the collective memory of Iranians. Also etched into people's psyche was how the U.S. and Britain engrossed their democratic aspirations in 1953 by orchestrating a coup against a popular government and returning the autocratic Shah to the throne. That coup consolidated the West's imperialistic agenda over Iran for a quarter of a century. In the 1970s, the Pahlavi regime was cheered by then-U.S. President Richard Nixon as one of, quote, America's cops on the beat in the Middle East for helping steer the oil-rich region away from the Soviet influence. In those days, the Pahlavi regime even obeyed the U.S. request to support its much-criticized war in Vietnam, sending warplanes, hosting American forces, and refueling warplanes. Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State under Nixon, admitted following the 1979 revolution that the Shah never failed to stand by the U.S. He described him as a man whom seven American presidents had lauded as a loyal ally. It was certainly a big blow for Washington to see the Shah ousted. The newly established Islamic Republic viewed both the U.S. and the Soviet Union as miscellaneous forces in international politics. The U.S. was referred to as the Great Satan, since it was the main backer of the Shah and posed the most immediate danger to the revolution. And the Soviet Union was regarded as the lesser Satan, since it was not seen as closely involved with the Iranian monarchy as the U.S. The most dramatic symbol of the revolutionary determination to assert independence was the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in November 1979 by a number of students. Angered by the U.S. admission of Shah, they asked Washington to hand over the former despot, a request that was never met. Iran's relations with the Soviet Union and its allies were tense as well, although at a low intensity. Tehran was opposed to numerous Soviet international policies, particularly its invasion of Afghanistan. In 1988, Imam Khomeini sent a letter to then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev warning him of an immediate danger. That letter has gone down in history as insightful and prophetic, from the leader of an independent nation to a superpower.
If you hope at this juncture to solve the economic problems of socialism and communism by appealing to the centers of the Western capitalism, you will, far from remedying any ill of your society, commit a mistake which those to come will have to erase.
The post-revolutionary Iran has now consolidated itself regionally and globally, forming warm relations with independent countries across the board. With the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Iran also pursued a look to the East policy, engaging in close collaboration with Russia and China. The independent Iran is now being regarded as a power that has contributed a lot to make the West Asian region more stable and peaceful. One such instance is Iran's role in defeating Daesh terrorism in Iraq, Syria, and beyond. Undoubtedly, Iran's Islamic Revolution was one of the biggest social upheavals of the 20th century. 43 years on, Imam Khomeini's words still resonate, and his powerful ideas of liberation from imperialistic domination, independence in domestic and foreign affairs, as well as call for embracing social justice and harmony continue to inspire not only Iranians, but people in the region and beyond.
Tensions between the West and Russia remain high, with the United States and its allies accusing Moscow of planning an invasion on its Western neighbor, Ukraine, and Russia denying all the accusations. The tensions are already starting to hurt Europe, which is largely dependent on Russian gas. The threats of sanctions on Russia are raising fears about a possible disruption of supply and demand in the energy market. There have been other factors at play, too. The cold winter, low gas storage levels, high European Union carbon prices, fewer liquefied natural gas tanker deliveries due to higher demand from Asia, lower than normal Russian gas supplies, and infrastructure outages are all cited as reasons why the continent is facing a potential energy crisis.
The crisis which we have is in part self-made by the European Union because they have allowed their storages to run pretty empty in winter time. This is crazy. And there's another story from the EU side, which is unprecedented, I think, in world's history, that there's a double pipeline brand new, ready to deliver on Germany's shores, coming directly from Russia. And we are refusing to use that second double pipeline.
That explains rising energy prices across the continent, with benchmark European gas prices at the Dutch TTF hub rising by 330% last year, while benchmark German and French power contracts have more than doubled. The United Kingdom is facing a rise in inflation at rates not seen in the past three decades. A major retail company is now warning that the worst is yet to come. Britain's biggest retailer, Tesco, says the prices of its products can go up to as much as 5% in the months to come. The company blames the matter on the rise in energy bills. Last week, the Bank of England raised interest rates for the second time in 3 months after forecasting that the peak inflation will reach a record 7% in April. What the European countries can't deny is that they need Russian gas. Take Germany, for example, which is expecting the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project to become operational. The pipeline would potentially supply 26 million German households. But the United States might be the one to prevent that from happening.
The notion that Nord Stream 2 would go forward with an invasion by the Russians is just not going to happen.
This is the situation, and it's Europe which is not, you know, trying to make a good connection with Russia and see to it that Nord Stream 2 starts producing, starts delivering. This is the situation. It's a crazy situation. And I think there is no situation like this in human history that the goods are ready, but the victim refuses the goods because there's a stronger guy behind, like Washington, like the US, stopping us.
The US has been warning of what it calls an imminent Russian attack on Ukraine, despite Ukrainian officials' statements that suggest the contrary. some NATO members are reluctantly backing Washington on this. But the Europeans are the ones who will have to bear the consequences of any conflict or tension on the continent, and not the U.S. Then, diplomacy and dialogue seem to be the only feasible options between the two sides, as further tensions won't be in anyone's interest.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The warmongering policies of the United States, whether in West Asia and East Europe, or in the South China Sea and Latin America, may trap its allies and client states into a quagmire from which it will be hard for them to extricate, says Kahan International staff writer in an article published under the heading U.S. warmongering poses dangers to world peace. Stay tuned for more. The warmongering policies of the United States, whether in West Asia and East Europe or in the South China Sea and Latin America, may trap its allies and client states into a quagmire from which it will be hard for them to extricate. Saudi Arabia is already feeling the folly of its headlong plunge into Yemen at the behest of Washington, with a heavy drain on its treasury, while the flames of the unwanted war are now about to boomerang on the UAE, which, with the weapons bought from the U.S., tried to punch above its size. The U.S. ought to know that it has no right to dictate its draconian policies to the free and independent countries, whether by sending troops to Europe to kick up the crisis in Ukraine or its current Navy drills in West Asia, along with such strange bedfellows as the Zionist regime in Saudi Arabia. The deployment of U.S. troops in Eastern Europe on the pretext that Russia might invade Ukraine augurs ill for all NATO members in case if the dangerous exchange of threats were to break out into a real military confrontation. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has criticized the U.S. and the West for creating unnecessary panic by the histrionic talk of a probable Russian invasion, saying that the economy of his country has already begun to suffer. Such policies definitely destabilize not only Ukraine, but the whole of Eastern Europe, even if the Joe Biden regime says there is no imminent danger of Russian invasion. Then why and on what basis the U.S. and other NATO members are pushing Eastern Europe to the brink of disaster? In the South China Sea, we see the same brinksmanship by the U.S. by poking its bloodied nose into Taiwan, which is a purely internal Chinese affair. Moreover, the presence of U.S. troops in South Korea and Japan bodes ill for these countries in case of a military flare-up. The same could be said of Washington's meddling policies in Latin America, where, at the moment, no effort is being spared to destabilize Venezuela, which, thanks to its leadership and the popularity it commands among the masses, has foiled successive U.S. conspiracies. Colombia stands to suffer greatly if the Americans were to carry out threats of military adventure in Venezuela. In West Asia, tensions are increasing as a result of unnatural bonds into which the U.S. has pushed some of its Arab client states with the illegal Zionist entity. Now, the military drills involving the Americans, the Israelis, and some Arab states that kicked off on January 31st at the U.S. 5th Fleet's headquarters in Bahrain is a dangerous exercise. The waters of the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Sea, the Gulf of Oman, the Red Sea, and the northern tip of the Indian Ocean have turned into a virtual war zone. Participants include a number of countries that the Zionist regime does not have formal ties with, such as Saudi Arabia, Oman, Comoros, Djibouti, Somalia, and Pakistan, as well as several countries with which the regime recently normalized relations, like the UAE and Bahrain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
And it is part of the mercy of Allah that you do deal gently with them. The Holy Quran, chapter 3, verse 159. There are many other descriptions, each of which says a great deal about the characteristics of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. However, a description of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that we Muslims have been ordered to repeat every day in daily prayers is that I testify that Muhammad is his servant and his messenger. This indicates a significance in the worship of God. Being a worshipper and servant of God is so remarkable that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted, teaches Muslims to repeat this dua several times during their daily prayers. Imam Rahmatullah Alayh enjoyed this characteristic, the characteristic of being a worshipper. He was a man of humility and supplication. He was a man that used to pray ardently, a worshipping believer. As for a third term, that is to say, being a pious revolutionary believer, I'd like to put a stress on this description and speak on it.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, was the Imam of the Revolution. Revolution is a word that contains countless realities. The Imam of the Revolution means being a leader of all the qualities and characteristics that the word revolution encompasses. The reason why materialistic powers were angry and irritated at, and of course afraid of, our magnanimous Imam rahmatullah alayh was that he enjoyed the characteristic of being a revolutionary. They chose to be enemies because of this characteristic that he embraced. Today, too, the enemies of the Iranian people exhibit hostility towards this revolutionary characteristic of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh. Basically, materialistic powers are intimidated by the word revolution. They are afraid of it, intimidated by it, and panic at the mention of the word Islamic revolution. The pressures that they exert on Iran originate from him, that is Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, being a revolutionary. Later on, I will explain more about the concepts, meanings, and guidelines behind being a revolutionary.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The images are difficult to look at, but the reality of life for so many people in Bahrain is still one of imprisonment and uncertainty. With a few days shy of the 11-year anniversary of the uprising in Manama and surrounding districts, activists in the UK are marking the occasion. One by one, the speakers took to the podium, erected on the pavement outside the Bahraini embassy in London, with a message of defiance and resistance.
We cannot continue to be controlled and ruled by hereditary dictatorships. That time has finished. It must cease to continue. It must come to an end. That is what our people in Bahrain want to achieve, and inshallah, they will achieve that.
In the decade plus since the revolution, Manama has even managed to export some of its violence.
They are participating in helping in bombing the Yemeni children, the Yemeni women. How can this be justified by the Bahraini regime? They are also, on the other hand, have sold the lands of the Arabs and Muslims in Palestine. They have kneeled to the wishes of the Zionists, the international Zionism.
Bahrain has featured on UK parliamentary agendas, has been the subject of official inquiries with the British government, but still no progress. This as activists seek a peaceful path to lasting reforms.
It's very unfortunate that what is called international community is headed by some who are the main reason for the problems in the world, the United States and Western Europe, who are backing the dictators rather than backing the people.
Activists argue the continuing atrocities committed against the Bahraini people can only happen with the consent of the international community, and are urging fresh action, not just words.
After over a decade of broken promises, false dawns, imprisonment, intimidation, torture, and even death, the brave freedom fighters for Bahrain have pledged to fight on to get Bahrain and its people the justice they're owed. Amina Taylor, London.
The central mosque of Kashmir's capital state, Srinagar, has stood for centuries as a pedestal of religious and political activities in this Muslim-majority region. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims from different parts of Kashmir would gather here on Fridays, filling lanes and roads to say prayers in this centuries-old mosque. But now, after India abrogated Kashmir's special status in August 2019, this 600-year-old mosque remains shuttered.
This is a place of worship. Why did they impose restrictions on our religious activities when there is no lockdown for other religious activities or social and political activities? Why here? COVID is just a pretext that the government is using.
The Indian authorities see the Grand Mosque as the epicenter for anti-India protests and clashes. For decades, authorities in Kashmir have struggled to contain the sentiments in this region claimed by both India and Pakistan, but ruled in parts. The mosque, with the capacity to hold 33,000 devotees, is surrounded by a wider market that is defunct following the closure.
Fridays or occasions like Eid were the days when we would earn sustenance. For the past 2.5 years, handling family and home affairs has been tough. If authorities continue to keep this mosque closed, our families would crumble and we will be pushed into poverty.
Though the religious freedom is enshrined in the Indian constitution, people in Indian-administered Kashmir say the continued closure of Kashmir's Grand Mosque belies India's claims of religious freedom, equality and justice in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
It was a night of happy tears and regret for Iranian cineasts and filmmakers. The closing ceremony of the 40th Fajr Film Festival saw the announcement of the best films on Friday. After 10 days of a tight competition, everybody now holds their breaths as the jury announces the winners. The award for Best Leading Actress went to Tanaz Tabatabai for her performance in Without Her.
It was hard, but we nailed it. I should thank every single one of the cast and crew. If it wasn't for their efforts, I would have not been standing here.
And acclaimed Iranian actor Amin Hayai nabbed the award for Best Leading Actor for starring in The Last Snow.
This is my second Simorgh Award. This time, too, I worked with crew members who put all their energy into the film. And this led me to win the award again.
A lineup of 22 films, mostly made by the new generation of Iranian filmmakers, competed for a Crystal Simorgh as the top prize of the festival. The Situation of Mehdi pocketed the awards in 5 categories, including Best Direction, Best Visual Effects, and Best Sound Mixing. as well as the Golden Seymour Award for the top film of the festival. Directed by Hadi Hejazi Farr, the war drama documents two major operations Iran carried out during the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War. Laureates believe the cinematic event has played a major role in upgrading the Iranian cinema industry.
I'm so happy to be acknowledged in my first presence as a director in the festival. I should thank all of those who supported me. The festival encourages the filmmakers to try to excel, and this is what makes the entire film industry grow.
Fajr Film Festival is held every year on the anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The 40th edition of the cinematic event kicked off on February the 1st and screened feature and short films as well as documentaries over the course of 10 days.
The 40th Fajr Film Festival rolled back the red carpet with smiles and tears. For sure, it was a memorable night for those who nabbed the Crystal Seymour, as their films will definitely go down in the list of the blockbusters of Iranian flicks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Painting pictures of a revolution that shook the world to its core more than four decades ago. Children born here, but staying connected to Iran.
I think the Islamic Revolution has brought a lot of joy to many people, and basically it shows that we are Muslims and we are proud of who we are.
The paintings are part of a ceremony at the Islamic Center of England, in the heart of London, on the 43rd anniversary of a day that changed the course of Iranian history.
Before Islamic Revolution in Iran, there was not such a good relationship, from the Pahlavi regime with a religion, and because it was based on a secular system.
Led from exile in France by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the uprising toppled a U.S.-backed despotic monarchy and replaced it with an Islamic republic, ushering in an era of political freedoms and independence from foreign influence. To the Shah's Western backers, the perceived loss of a modernized Iran under his rule to an Islamic Republic was a consequential blow to their interests in the region. What followed was four difficult decades that saw a devastating Western-backed war in the 1980s, an ongoing economic war, military threats, and relentless demonization.
The West hates Iran. They surround it with military bases. They supplied bombs and ammunition and poison gas. The extraordinary thing, though, is that Iran is probably at a point where instead of being on the defensive, it may be able to go forward and give a lead to a world badly in need of a new lead.
To other non-Iranians, the revolution has qualities that makes it relevant to the world today.
For me, as a Muslim in the 21st century, it's important to try to find leadership that instills the concept of taqwa, that instills the concept of piety, and talks about the concept of unity.
For more than four decades now, Iran has defied many who had predicted the revolution's imminent collapse. At 43, these participants tell us it's a stable country in an unstable region, powerful militarily, and as united as ever against hegemonic powers. Saeed Pourreza, London.
France has totally rejected a legal request for the release of Europe's oldest political prisoner, Georges Ibrahim Abdallah, who is known as the Arab Nelson Mandela. In 1982, Israel had invaded Lebanon yet again. Abdullah's resistance group accepted responsibility for the deaths of an Israeli and an American agent in Paris, saying they were the legitimate acts of self-defense of a country under foreign invasion. Abdullah's trial was noted for its lack of proof, and his own lawyer later confessed to secretly working for the government. Ultimately, it seems that France has inaccurately classified Abdallah not as a soldier, but as a common criminal. There have been favorable court decisions for Abdallah over the decades. but governmental interference has not allowed them to be implemented or respected. If France refuses to let their courts release Abdullah, then it seems they are intent on forcing him to die in jail, and in a country which prides itself on having abolished the death penalty a few decades ago. Abdullah refuses to repent or to recant his support for Palestine, and many believe that's a primary reason why he hasn't been released.
George is a fighter. He'll have no problem with this latest injustice. After 37 years of harassment, bullying, and humiliation, he is well aware that the deck is stacked against him. George maintains a vast global correspondence despite his imprisonment, and he still lives for the movement of anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, and leftist politics.
The fight for the liberation of George Abdullah has gone from total obscurity to becoming an international cause, with anti-French protests recently held in North Africa, Lebanon, and even Latin America. Demonstrators say that they and Abdullah's supporters worldwide will never stop fighting for his liberation from French injustice. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelly, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally.
For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution. As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here. And they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth. They're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
Iranians from different walks of life have marked the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Millions of Iranians were out on motorcycles, cars, and bicycles in the streets and squares all over the country due to coronavirus pandemic, waving flags of Iran and banners in support of their country.
I'm 15 years old. I'm here as a young adult to say that we don't care what the enemies are saying against the Islamic Revolution. We are here to show our support for our leader and our country.
I'm 43 years old as the Islamic Revolution. I'm here to voice my support for the Islamic establishment. When we see people are taking part in rallies across the country, it means that we have security and tranquility. Accordingly, we are here to honor the blood of our martyrs and celebrate our day of independence.
Speaking on the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said the country's foreign policy relies on balance and progress hinges on unity and convergence, and Iran does not pin hope on the West.
I trust in God and I trust in people. Our foreign policy is based on balance, but the view towards the West has caused an imbalance. Our hopes are in God and our own regions, including provinces of